Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome you all to the 8th Staudinger Lecture of FRIAS LifeNet this afternoon. My name is Lena Bruckner-Tudermann. I am the director of LifeNet, School of Life Sciences in FRIAS. We have organized Staudinger Lectures now for about 2.5 years. These have always been extremely interesting with high caliber speakers. Today's speaker, Professor Robert Huber, is Nobel laureate like all the other Staudinger lecturers so far. And we are very honored that he has accepted to come today to tell us about his work. The Staudinger lectures will continue, we hope, for the next few years. We have several speakers lined up already 2 or 3 times a year. For the next year, this tradition will continue at least, and hopefully in the future as well. As you all know, FRIAS, Freiburg Institute for Advanced Studies, is an interdisciplinary institution where different disciplines, life sciences, technical sciences, soft matter research, and humanities, literature, languages, and history are together and develop new ideas and new interactions in an old-fashioned, if you like, manner where full university includes interactions of all people involved. This has turned out to be an excellent idea, and very fruitful collaborations have been generated. And in this tradition, Staudinger lectures are also open to all people at the university, and we are happy to see that many students are here today also in order to enjoy interdisciplinary new information. Now I would like to give the microphone to Professor Einsle, who will introduce today's speaker.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for appearing in such large numbers for this lecture. Our speaker of today is Robert Huber, who is the Emeritus Director of the Department of Structural Research of the Max Planck Institute for Biochemistry in Martinsried. And I have actually just printed his CV from the web, which turns out to be not very long, but what's long is the list of honors and degrees he has received afterwards. Robert Huber has studied chemistry at the Technical University of Munich, and he just told me that he had his 50-year anniversary of the diploma this year. He has, after that, conducted his PhD research in Munich. He has done his habilitation in Munich, and in 1972 he became a member of a scientific member and a director of the Max Planck Institute of Biochemistry, that around that time I guess moved out of the city to Martinsried and built a beautiful new campus. And Robert started pretty much the field of crystallography in Germany at a time where all structural research by X-ray diffraction techniques was carried out in Cambridge, UK. And if you ever spend some time living in Bavaria, you realize that all Bavarians are well aware that there is nothing so complicated in this world that it couldn't be done just as well in Bavaria. And and this is exactly what happened. So Robert built up a center for structural research, and we will hear about research, we will hear about structures that have been solved, we will hear about great work that has been done, but most of all, Robert created a lot of infrastructures. He opened a lot of directions and technological developments that we now, at a time where we do crystallography on basically on laptops like this one, easily forget, took a long while to get established and developed. So Robert is a extraordinary professor at the Technical University of Munich, where I think he's still working today. And his list of honors includes a total of, if I counted correctly, please correct me, 8 honorary doctorates and 8 honorary professorships. He has received about every medal that is out there in the field, including the Große Verdienstkreuz mit Stern und Schulterband der Bundesrepublik Deutschland. I actually admit I had to look that up, and it's not a small thing at all, but he also received the Röntgenplakette der Stadt Remscheid-Lennep. That is the birthplace of Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen. Of course, he received the Nobel Prize of Chemistry in 1988 for a discovery they made and published in 1985, which was the structure of the photosynthetic reaction center from Rhodopseudomonas viridis. And that was not only a structure that explained how photosynthesis works, how the primary process of energy conversion on Earth works, but it was also the first structure of a membrane protein, which is something that still keeps us quite busy today. And it was an achievement that is still, you know, hard to really estimate in its significance for the field. Robert is a member of, I might almost say, the Deutsche Akademie für Naturforscher, Leopoldina. He's a member of the Bavarian Academy of Science. He is a member of the Royal Society and of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States, of the Order Pour le Mérite for Sciences and Arts, and of quite a series of further societies and academies. I'm very happy that we have him here. I'm going to stop now, Robert, and hand over to you. And we are not hearing about the reaction center, I understand, but we are going to hear about proteolysis, which is another fundamental topic you contributed. Please. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. The microphone works. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate Oliver's kind words and the invitation by Frias to meet the students. I enjoyed it, meet the students of Oliver's group and of the graduate school, and entertained a number of questions, as usual. What did happen after the Nobel Prize? How did you feel during the ceremony? Things like this. Well, this is not what I'm going to tell you today. Instead, I thought I should speak about the topic proteolysis that followed through all of my career. I have been criticized, actually, of jumping from system to system as they came. One of these jumps was to photosynthesis. It was a very successful jump, but it was actually a side project. And a main project that I followed through all my career was, as I said, proteolysis. And it began with a very small protein involved in proteolysis that was the basic pancreatic trypsin inhibitor, which has 57 amino acid residues. We developed techniques at that time using this material. It was also the material with which protein NMR was developed. So the first spectra and the first interpretation of spectral lines was with basic pancreatic trypsin inhibitor in the 70s. Now, field has moved, and the proteases I'm going to describe today are more than 100 times larger than the basic pancreatic trypsin inhibitor. They are involved in interesting mechanisms and they have interesting structures, and they are quite interesting for application in medicine. Now, proteolytic activity is potentially quite dangerous. It needs regulation. Otherwise, I would melt away in front of you during my lecture if my proteases would not be tightly regulated. And we find regulation at all levels, transcription, translational level. We find activation of inactive precursors, we find inhibition, and we find degradation. Well, another quite important aspect to show is the enormous diversity of proteinases. Proteolytic activity is a very simple chemical reaction, so boiling proteins in acid or base cleaves them into the components, the amino acids. But in biology, we need, through all the organisms, about 3% of the genetic material and encoding proteinases. An enormous diversity. Diversity also concerning the detailed mechanism, the detailed structures. We group them according to the nucleophile essential for the chemical reaction as threonine, serine, metallo, cysteine, or aspartic proteinases. But within these groups, let us just focus on the serine proteases, we find they share a serine as the essential nucleophile, like the trypsin, like enzyme thrombin, chymotrypsin, and so on and so forth. But in this group, there are totally unrelated proteins, evolutionary unrelated, and a prominent example seen already many years ago is the satelicin family compared to the trypsin family. They share a catalytic machinery, but they have totally different structures and are certainly not evolutionarily related. So an enormous diversity, and the diversity is due to the fact that proteolytic activity is for an essential mechanism of physiological regulation. I just mentioned one. This is blood clotting, for instance. This is a series of proteolytic activities starting from the signal, a wound, to the formation of the thrombus, a series of proteolytic actions by a large number of, in this case, trypsin-like proteases. Well, what we did over these 40 years of protease research was looking at the structural basis of regulation. I told you how important protease regulation is. Now, how are they regulated at the level of the mature protein? Now, the simplest one, and this is what we discovered by looking at the basic pancreatic trypsin inhibitor, is a stereochemical, chemically exactly fitting small proteinaceous inhibitor fitting to the enzyme without any substantial structure change. So they are built to fit, and they fit so tightly and bind so strongly that substrate cannot displace the inhibitor and is not turned over. Now, we found enzymes that are extremely specific. They cleave out of a particular protein only a sequence of amino acids in a segment and do not touch anything else. Now, again, the structural basis of this sequence substrate specificity is steric complementarity. It's a very complex binding site of the protease to which only a particular long, relatively long sequence fits, which is then precisely cleaved. We do have regulation by proenzyme cleavage. So many of the proteases are made as precursors, which are inactive, which makes great sense. Trypsin is made as trypsinogen in the pancreas. If it would be made as an active enzyme in the pancreas, it would digest the organ it is made. So it is made as a proenzyme, then secreted, and then activated in the intestine, in the stomach, for instance. And the general mechanism of proenzyme activation is by cleaving off a part, usually an N-terminal part, which falls away. The active site becomes accessible, the enzyme becomes active. But there is alternative systems where the cleavage of the pro part involves an allosteric structural change. An interesting aspect to which I will come later. We do have substrate and enzyme membrane bound, membrane anchored. So all of the clotting enzymes are of this kind. They have a short membrane anchor, and of course this limits then the enzymatic activity to the membrane, the vessel surface. A very effective way of regulating enzymatic activity to a site. We do have cofactors. This blue little piece that you see here may bind to the enzyme, and the substrate needs the binding to the cofactor in order to be stably bound to the enzyme to be processed. Without the blue cofactor, the substrate is not stably bound, is not processed. But we also have, and you will see an example, a case where the cofactor binds to the enzyme and modifies it allosterically. And only this allosterically altered form then is able to bind substrate and process it. And there is the very large, mostly intracellular proteases, very large containers, which have their binding sites inside these cages, and regulation is by closing or opening the access into the particle. This is what I'm mostly describing today. And the last is a quite new, rather interesting kind of regulation, which is related to this cofactor principle I described, but it adds to it the oligomerization. So when substrate binds, then the enzyme is activated and forms a cage around the substrate. So we will see pictures of that too. Well, now this is the life cycle of a protein. It's made on the ribosome. It's in a state where it needs some help. Often it needs chaperones until it is folded. But even then, proteins are quite sensitive materials, and if they encounter stress, heat, pressure, radiation, then they become non-functional, they lose part of their structure, and this is then where the proteases come in order to degrade them into peptides, amino acids, which are then used for resynthesis. Now these intracellular proteases, which deal with the removal and many other things, as you will see, stress proteins, non-functional proteins in cells are shown here. All of these are very large protein aggregates with molecular weights approaching a million Dalton. They have very different shapes, as you can see, but they have in common, in all cases, that the active sites are buried inside these cages. And regulation is by opening or closing access. Now, I begin with the most important of these, on which we worked already more than 10 years, the proteasome. This was the first structure that we determined, an archaeal proteasome, which showed the basic architecture. So it's made from four rings, and each of these rings is a heptamer of subunits. So there are 28 subunits. The alpha rings, the beta rings. The beta rings are associated with the activity, as you will see. Now, this was the first of these structures, the relatively chemically simple archaeal enzyme. We then moved on to the eukaryotic enzyme, and we have chosen yeast. But yeast and human is very, very similar sequence-wise. And the yeast enzyme showed the basic architecture of the eukaryotic proteasome, architecture identical to that of the simple archaeal one. But now here, all of the alphas, which were identical in the archaeal enzyme, are now different. So you, a wonderful example of evolution. So from maintaining the basic building scheme, differentiation is by altering the subunits and, of course, changing the functional properties. Well, this is another representation, an all-atom representation. This is a ribbon plot, and this is a surface representation where you see substrate or inhibitor bound to the inner face of this cage that is formed by the beta subunits. There are two times seven beta subunits of different chemistries, as I said, but only six of these 14 subunits are active. Now, in the archaeal enzyme, all these beta subunits are identical. They are all active. So evolution involves the inactivation of some subunits, which is also contrary to expectation. But it allows now to differentiate the specificity of these subunits. So the 2 times 3 subunits do have different cleavage specificities. In the archaeal enzyme, of course, there is only one specificity. Now, again, the role of the proteasome in cells in antigen processing. So the proteasome makes the ligands to the MHC class 1 molecules. There is no T-cell mediated immune response without the products of the proteasome. It regulates the cell cycle because it degrades the cell cycle signaling molecules. There is ubiquitination before that, and I show a picture to that. It is involved in cell differentiation, again, by degrading, removing signaling molecules. And, of course, it is involved in stress response simply by removing stressed non-functional proteins. So it's an absolutely essential molecule in bacterial, that is, in archaeal and in eukaryotic cells. This is again a picture showing now the ubiquitination cascade. So the discovery of this was honored with the Nobel Prize 2004 to Hershko, Rose, and Chikanova. They discovered the role of the ubiquitin chain as a signal for the degradation of this protein molecule, which is labeled. And this signal is recognized by the proteasome, which then unfolds the protein molecule and degrades it. Now, I mentioned already the waste cleaning property function of the proteasome, so it recognizes denatured proteins and degrades them, and I mentioned the role in immune response. Well, what did we find from the structure? First, the enzymatic mechanism. It was a new protease. As I said, the active sites are buried inside, and the active sites are associated with an N-terminal threonine. There is an N-terminal threonine, which is the nucleophile, and this is the essential residue that leads to cleavage of a peptide bond by adding to the carbonyl, to the electrophilic carbonyl carbon. So cleavage is here and is mediated by the N-terminal threonine. Now, I said already, we do have seven different beta subunits, of which three are active because they have an N-terminal threonine, while the other four do have N-terminal extensions. They do not have a nucleophile as an active site residue, and they are inactive. But they are necessary. This was known already since some time that you cannot delete any of these proteasomal subunits. Deletion of any of them, even those that are enzymatically inactive, leads to death of the yeast cells simply because the proteasome cannot be built up. So each of these 28 subunits is necessary to build this complex molecule, and none can replace another one. There is the story of the immune proteasome, but I have no time to talk about this. Well, it turned out that the proteasome, despite being such an essential component in cells for the survival of the cell, is a target for drugs. This was surprising. It was a finding nobody expected, but it turns out that a boronate compound, which, as we know and have shown by our structural studies, targets the proteasome, is a drug against some forms of multiple myeloma. So this was very much appreciated by the pharma community because it showed a new drug, an entirely new drug for this form of cancer. And so an enormous activity began worldwide to find different compounds that target the proteasome. And what you see here in yellow is compounds that one found in libraries of natural compounds that target the proteasome and are potential leads in developing proteasome inhibitors. Very different chemistries, and I show a few of them before. This is marketed bortezomib, which is very successful on the market, and as I said, stimulated research on proteasome inhibitors very much. Now, this is the electron density of this boronic acid ester formed with the N-terminal threonine and the side chains here. Well, there is another aspect that recently came up, namely the proteasome as a target for new antibiotics for malaria and for tuberculosis. Very interesting work again, showing a different application of proteasome inhibitors, again, rather intensively pursued. Now, we did what we do. We did structures of these various compounds. So these are the electron densities. This is an aldehyde-based compound that forms heme acetal with the N-terminal threonine. This again is an aldehyde base. This is a vinyl sulfon, which adds to the this was the vinyl group, and the hydroxyl group of the threonine adds to it, so forming a covalent bond. These are some natural compounds of inhibitors of the eukaryotic proteasome. This was the first one actually described already 15 years ago, lactate-cystine, which is a beta-lacton which acylates the threonine. This is epoxamycin, which was a beta-epoxy-ketone and forms a morpholino ring. So it reacts not only with the hydroxyl but also with the amino group. So fantastic compounds, and this is a non-covalently binding proteasome inhibitor. There are variations of this. I just told you about the beta-lactone. There is a variant of this lactate-cystine, which is called xylenosporamide, which does have a substituent, a chloroethyl group. Now, when the compound acylates the N-terminal threonine, then a free hydroxyl group is generated here, and this is reacting with the chloroethyl group to form a tetrahydrofuran ring, to form this compound, making the reaction absolutely irreversible. It's quite fantastic how full of fantasy nature is. Nobody had thought of this variation of the lactone moiety. Well, there are many more examples which I would should skip and come to this one of the last discoveries that we made here together with Robert Dudler, who is a plant biologist in Zurich, who had discovered that a bean plant pathogen secretes a pathogen that kills bean plants. It causes these lesions and kills the leaves and kills the plants. This pathogen secretes a virulence factor, which he calls uringulin, which has this formula. And the mode of action then we found by discovering that this is a proteasome inhibitor. And you see this alpha, beta, beta, gamma, this unsaturated keto group to which the hydroxyl group of the threonine adds irreversibly and then very tightly binds to it. Now, this is an experiment that we did by showing the effect of syringolin on the plant cells and the accumulation of polyubiquitin labeled cyclin B. Cyclin B is a cell cycle signaling molecule. And when the proteasome is inactivated, then the labeled, the polyubiquitin labeled cyclin is no longer degraded, it accumulates as you see here, and the cells die. So this is the action of Pseudomonas syringae. An interesting aspect was also discovered by Dudler and by us doing the crystallography, that there is a human disease, a quite serious human disease, melioidosis, caused by a bacterium called Gliobactin, which makes a compound which is very, very similar to this plant syringolin, and we think that it does exactly the same. It causes a lung disease. What it does, we suggest on the basis of what we know from syringolin, that it kills lung cells by inhibiting its proteasome in chemically quite the same way as we saw it with syringolin. So a lot of activity. Well, we thought this is beyond our capacity as an academic institute, and we took the opportunity to suggest to a new organization, a new daughter by the Max Planck Society called Lead Discovery Center, to take up this project of developing proteasome inhibitors. Now, what I do is just giving you an idea of how we work with the many structural data that we have in order to help the chemists for drug design. So this is an empty binding site of a beta subunit, of an active, of the so-called beta 5 active subunit. And this is the site of the threonine. This is this Velcade, this bortezomib binding, and these are these many other inhibitors that we found. And this is a superposition. So the idea now is that we have defined binding sites of these individual molecules, but using the information, we can combine them in different ways, developing the proper chemistry, of course, for that. So this is what we are trying to do now, use the structural information to design and then make new chemistries, new entities as proteasome inhibitors, as a combination of the already structurally defined inhibitors. Well, I see that time passes by very quickly, I see. Well, yes, sure, I go on. But I simply have to skip and come to the next system. So I spoke about the archaeal proteasome, which has this characteristic barrel architecture, the alpha rings, the beta rings, alpha rings, and an exact sevenfold axis. These are the eukaryotic proteasomes, the same architecture, but now all the alphas and all the betas are different. Wonderful example of diversification during evolution. Now, most bacteria do not have a proteasome. So this is archaeal. E. coli does not have a proteasome, but it has a closely related molecule, which is HSLV, heat-shock locus V, and heat-shock locus U. Now, the U is the activator of the V. The V is the protease, and it turns out that the protease is quite similar to the beta subunits of the archaeal proteasome, although it is not heptameric, but it is hexameric. So nature plays around with symmetry. So symmetry is not God's own element, which is there and maintained. It is the structure of the individual subunits, which are very similar, but you can associate them as heptameric or as hexameric rings. And of course, the heptameric ring is somewhat larger. So there is a purpose behind that. So the E. coli, HSLV, forms again a cage. These are the active sites buried inside here. And then, of course, we were mostly interested in how this HSLU, which is the activator, is associated with the protease and what it does with the protease. Now, the HSLU is an ATPase. So its function is, in an ATP-dependent manner, to unfold proteins, which are then led into the HSLV chamber where it is degraded. So we worked on these crystals for a long time and found, when we looked at crystals of the ATPase alone, that there is a substantial motion about by ATP binding and ATP release. Now, the functional implications of this are not yet clear, but we know that the substrate binds up here, the protease is waiting here, and consuming ATP, the ATP moves. So what does it do? How does that lead to unfolding? So the idea is that the folded protein binds up here and then is unfolded by the ATPase, and a single strand of peptide is then diffusing through a narrow tunnel of this hexameric subunits into the waiting protease chamber. So the question I often ask physicists is, how can a moving mole be leading to unfolding of a folded protein? We still don't know. It's like massaging. Well, we all enjoy massaging, but it should not lead to unfolding as it does here in the protein world. Well, this is evolution. This is the archaeal proteasome. It's beta and alpha subunits, which form this 28-meric aggregate. This is the E. coli HSLV. The subunit structure is related. I showed it already. And then we have the evolution from the prokaryotes to the eukaryotes, where suddenly all of the alphas and all of the betas become different. This is a major step in evolution, which we do not understand at all, because in the modern proteasome that we see in eukaryotes now, we know that none of these alphas can replace any other one, and none of the betas in the same way. On the other hand, we can't imagine that in one simple step, an all the same becomes an all different. It must have proceeded stepwise, but we have no trace of any proteasome that has been analyzed so far that shows these intermediates. We have either this or this. Well, in archaea, to go back to the Thermoplasma acidophyllum, I showed you the proteasome, the chemically simple proteasome, which makes peptides, mostly octapeptides. Now, an archaeal bacterium can't make use of an octapeptide. It that can make use of amino acids. And there is, in fact, a large machinery involved in Archaea which makes out of the octapeptides, the proteasome products, dipeptides, and then makes out of the dipeptides single amino acids. Now, the next object we looked at was the strychnine, which preferentially binds octapeptides and makes dipeptides. It's again a large aggregate, so each of these subunits, so it's a hexameric subunit, a 3-2 symmetrical aggregate, about 1,200 amino acid residues. Very different in shape to the proteasome, you see, but it has in common the fact that the active sites are inside the particle and the substrate has to move into the protein, and it has to move into the protein, as we know from substrate analog binding studies, through these propeller structures, and we know that the products move out through the other side of the molecule, again, a propeller structure which is somewhat narrower than this one. So how do we know? Now we know from inhibitor binding studies, we know that a peptide has to unfold completely to pass through this narrow tunnel of this propeller. Then it approaches the active site, is cleaved into dipeptides, which move out through the other side. So there is processive cleavage, as it is called. So it acts like a bread slicer until the octapeptide is completely degraded. There are no intermediates released. This is meant by processive. Well, now, SILT is the principal construction scheme. There is the entry through a beta-7 propeller. There is the exit through a beta-6 propeller. And at the exit, there are the aminopeptidases waiting. The product is a dipeptide. And these dipeptides are processed by so-called F1 and F3 proteases. Now, the F1 protease looks like this, and it binds to the exit propeller structure. We know that from modeling. This is F1, and it is a member of a series which is called F1, PIP, PAP, and POP. And the POP structure, the most interesting for us, POP stands for prolyl oligopeptidase. It has a catalytic domain, which is the F1 domain, and it has associated, so along the polypeptide chain, a propeller domain, which is rather similar to the exit propeller of the trichorn. So the model that we have is in Archaebacteria, we have the proteasome that degrades a complete unfolded polypeptide, makes octapeptides. These are processed by trichorn, which makes dipeptides, and F1 makes amino acids. Now, of course, we tried to crystallize these three components, which we couldn't. The complexes, we have good indications from small angle scattering, from functional studies, that these three components are together, but too short-lived, too unstable to survive the crystallization experiments. So this is a huge machine. It's actually bigger than the ribosome, for nothing but degrading what the ribosome has made before and make use again of the amino acid building blocks. Well, so I should spend the last how many minutes, Oliver? 10? Oh, great. Thank you. To a relatively recent work that I had the privilege to be associated with its work of Michael Ehrmann in Duisburg-Essen and Tim Clausen in Vienna. I think Tim was here for a lecture some time ago. In January, right. I don't know whether he talked about this system or something else. Now, if he talked about the system, perhaps we have forgotten already. And, not right. So this is the so-called HTRA or DEC system. Well, this I skip. This is a large family of proteases which occur in bacteria, in plants, in mammalian species. So the proteins consist of a trypsin-like domain which looks like the digestive trypsin and has properties like the digestive trypsins. But it has in addition in all of the members a so-called PDC domain, sometimes two of them, sometimes it's even a duplication of this structural scheme. There is an N-terminal domain whose function is not yet so clear. So what is clear is the function of the trypsin domain, which is the digestive, the protease portion, and the PDC domain, which is the regulatory domain. Now, PDC domains are very well known in the protein world as modules that bind C-terminal ends of proteins. So they serve protein-protein interaction. Now, what they do here, you will see in a minute. So again, this is a repetition of the bacterial DECP, closely related to the human. So the catalytic domain, here two PDC domains and an N-terminal domain. Now, these DECs in gram-negative bacteria like E. coli are in the center of the so-called unfolded protein response. Now, what is this? This is a mechanism. This is a mechanism by which unfolded proteins, in particular mislocalized outer membrane proteins, are recognized and are removed. So the system that is involved here first must recognize unfoldedness of an outer membrane protein, and then in a second step remove it or rescue it, as you will see, and in a second step then also trigger the expression of additional helping proteins. I have no time to go into that. And the mechanism behind that is that a component, a membrane-bound component bound in the cytoplasmic membrane, is degraded with a DEC, an activated DEC protein, which then releases a transcription factor which leads to the expression of additional helping factor. So let me concentrate on this part of the picture, the recognition of unfoldedness of outer membrane proteins and their degradation. This is a porin. Well, we owe the first pictures of this structure to Georg Schulz. I hope he is around. I spoke to him today. A major achievement. was made in Freiburg. It was the second membrane protein structure analyzed after our alpha helical reaction center. Now here Georg saw the other principal type of membrane proteins. These are the beta barrel proteins. Well, the structure, so it forms a trimeric molecule, and the individual subunits are characterized by a C-terminus. This is this red segment, which is tightly associated with the barrel. So this is a perfectly folded, very stable molecule, but when it is not perfectly folded, then obviously one of the first signs of unfoldedness is that the C-terminus is loose, is not associated with the barrel. And you will see in a minute that this is the trigger for the activation, the recognition of unfoldedness and the activation of the DEC proteins. Now, the first structure that we found some years ago, that was Kroya, Ehrmann, and Klaus and myself, was the hexameric form of DEC-P, and we found it in the same crystal in two conformations. These are orthogonal views, so it's a hexameric protein. We look along the threefold axis, we see the green trypsin-like domains, and we see the two PDC domains in the periphery. This is an orthogonal view, and we see a very much closed molecule. But in the same crystal, in the same unit cell, was a second form, which looks like this. It has the same trimeric trypsin arrangement of trypsins, but it has a very loose packing of the PDC domains. That already showed us that the PDC, that we have a stable element, these are the trimeric trypsins, and we have this very flexible PDC domains. Now, this hexameric form is enzymatically inactive. And we understand why it is enzymatically inactive, because the active site, it is a trypsin-like molecule, and we can compare it with trypsin. The substrate binding site and the active site is completely distorted. Now, what you see here in gray is trypsin, and you see bound substrate to the trypsin, so it needs the extended structure of this gray segment. Now, in DEC-P hexamer, this is completely distorted. So this loop is folded over the active site, so it can't bind substrate and it can't be active. So we clearly understand the inactivity of this form. And then in 2008, Kroya, Ehrmann, and Clausen made a key observation. And I show you the experiment. So they incubated DEC-P hexamer inactive with casein and did an HPLC run after 1 minute. Now, after 1 minute, then you see the casein peak, and you do not longer see a DEC-P hexamer peak, but you see instead a DEC-P 24-mer peak. And if you wait 30 minutes, then all of the casein is digested, no casein, just fragments, and you have the hexamer again. So this was a key experiment showing that the substrate, casein, induces the formation of 24-mers, so higher oligomers which are active. Now, then sample, the 24-mer material crystallized, and it formed these great, wonderful shells which had 24 of these subunits made up from the basic trimers, so the basic trimeric structure which we of the trypsins which we saw in the inactive hexamer was preserved, but the PDC domains are entirely differently arranged, but they are in fixed positions to make this cage. And inside the cage, disordered and not having defined electron density, there is an OMP bound, but you see the OMP when you dissolve the crystal and do a gel chromatography. They also did, with Helen Seibel in London, electron microscopy of a different oligomer, a 12-mer oligomer, and by electron microscopy one could see an OMP bound inside this diffuse density that you see in EM is representing the OMP. Well, now the higher oligomers, the 24-mers, are active. And they are active because now the substrate binding site is properly formed. This was the inactive hexamer with the distorted substrate binding loop. Now this is removed, is in a proper conformation so that substrate can bind. So an easy explanation of the activation by oligomerization. Well, these are then the details of the activation by oligomerization. This is, I had no time to go into that, the trigger for the oligomerization is the binding of the C-terminus of the substrate to the PDC domain. So this is the trigger, and the structure studies have shown that you can see the trigger, you can induce the oligomerization by the peptide alone and form the oligomer. Well, now what is DECP hexamer, which is inactive, does is shown on this scheme. There is an unfolded OMP. That is, it does not have to be entirely unfolded. It just needs a loose C-terminus, which is the trigger. So this trigger signals the oligomerization, the formation from the hexamer of a 24-mer or of a 12-mer large enough to enclose the OMP. Now what happens? This OMP is now surrounded by 24 greedy proteases, trypsin-like proteases. But experiments showed that it has a chance. It has a chance inside this particle to refold. It just needs to incorporate its loose C-terminus into the barrel structure. And once the signal is removed, then the higher oligomer dissociates into hexamers and releases the active and properly folded OMP to be integrated into the outer membrane. So there is a decision to be made between death and life. We still don't know how that decision is made, but I think it's simply the degree of unfoldedness. So if the refolding is relatively quick, at least faster than the rate by which the proteases attack the substrate, then the protein has a chance to refold. So this is known as the chaperone function of the DEX, and this is the protease function. Well, I had to be very quick, I'm sorry for that. This is Munich right now, I would say, either in winter or in spring, almost as beautiful as Freiburg is. Thank you.
breaking down things can be just as complicated as building things. Do we have questions at this point?
Why does the proteasome use a threonine and not a serine? What is the turnaround time of that?
Well, these mutations have been done. So the serine mutant is not entirely inactive. It has an activity which is about, if I remember, 20% of that of the threonine. The reason, I can't tell you. So serine does it, but slower than the threonine.
Because the environment.
Yeah. But this, I think, is quite well defined. So the hydroxyl group adds to the carbonyl carbon, and then, of course, either the reaction goes back, or it leads to the acyl enzyme with cleavage of the peptide bond. And then, of course, there must be a proton transfer. There is a lysine close by, which manages this. So the lysine would play the role of the histidine in the classical serine proteases, we think. Well, is it so slow? I should know that. It's not so easy to measure kinetics of the proteasome and compare it with trypsin. Now, trypsin is simple. This is a single molecule. Now, here you have the entry, the kinetics of the entry into the active site. So, I don't think you have reliable good numbers to compare the activity of the simple trypsin with that of the proteasome, simply because of the much higher complexity of the overall reaction.
Now, if the Chicago biologists speak of low and fast, what does it mean?
Biology, slow and fast. Well, depending on the physiology behind that, let me illustrate this not with the proteases, but with photosynthesis. You have these extremely fast primary reactions, the picosecond reactions of the light energy transfer in the harvesting complexes and the electron transfer in the reaction center itself. And you have the very slow secondary processes, very slow, because in the end it leads to the synthesis of storage material. All of that takes days. Now, why do you need picosecond for the primary reaction if the following reactions take days? In that case, the answer is relatively simple. You need these very fast primary reactions in order to avoid deactivation of excitation energy. So I would say you could build on this example for any other physiological process. So it has the speed that it needs for optimal performance, I would say. Yes. Yeah. Yes. This term I coined in Wolfram Bode in 1976. I skipped that story, but I'm very happy about your question, I must say. I had it in the presentation because it was the first example of having an allosteric effect in a single subunit molecule. Now, allostery in the 70s was associated with hemoglobin and the quaternary structure change, you see. So this defined allostery. Allostery is quaternary structure change. Now, when we worked on trypsin and trypsinogen, we found that trypsinogen can be activated allosterically by a signaling strongly binding peptide, namely a peptide that mimics the N-terminus of active trypsin. Now, you know, trypsinogen is activated into trypsin by cleaving off a hexapeptide. Then there is a new N-terminus, which then inserts into the molecule and makes this trypsinogen-trypsin transition. And when we saw this, we said, now, why should that not happen with an exogenous peptide? And the second important experiment, if you use a very, very strong ligand to trypsin and associate and let it interact with trypsinogen, then trypsinogen is changed into a trypsin-like conformation. So BPTI, this basic pancreatic trypsin inhibitor, forms with trypsinogen exactly the same complex that it forms with trypsin, although the N-terminus, this non-cleaved N-terminus, is still there. So all of this showed, these two experiments showed, there is allostery. So there is a signal of the N-terminus, and there is the generation of the binding site. Now, we said, now this is an artificial system. It was the system, trypsin, trypsinogen, BPTI, an activating peptide. And we said, now this is a mechanism that nature should use as well. And we published that in Fab's letters saying, this is the mechanism of molecular sexuality, and we will find it. And now I show you how we found it. Well, this is the trypsinogen-trypsin conformation change. So the red segment shows trypsinogen, and then when this is cleaved, the N-terminus folds in and the whole activation domain refolds, forming active trypsin. Now, this is the trypsinogen-trypsin BPTI peptide, the system I just described. And this is what we published as molecular sexuality. Now, it took 20 years until people looked at plasminogen and streptokinase. Plasminogen is the equivalent of trypsinogen, and streptokinase would be an activator. It was known that streptokinase, it's actually a therapeutic protein, activates plasminogen without generating plasmin, so without this proteolytic cleavage. And these people in 2000 found that the N-terminus of streptokinase, which has the same sequence as the N-terminus of active plasmin, does that. and also cited us in the molecular sexuality. Then we went on with an American biochemist, Paul Bock, who had found that staphylococci secrete a virulence factor called staphylocoagulase, which does the same thing with prothrombin. It binds to prothrombin and activates it without inducing the cleavage. And we did the structure with him. And this is it. This is prothrombin. This is staphylocoagulase. And this is the N-terminus of staphylocoagulase, which binds exactly in the classical binding site of the thrombin N-terminus. This is the electron density. So this is not thrombin electron density, but this is staphylocoagulase N-terminal density. These are mutational data showing that. So this is it. We were extremely happy that 20 years after our molecular sexuality hypothesis, we were able to prove it. Thank you for your question.
Okay. In context with this, it always leaves me a bit uneasy that the N-terminus actually gets cleaved after insertion, but we may want to move the remaining discussions about sexuality and proteolysis outside.